The presenting sponsor of the Bloodstream podcast is Takeda. And if Natalie were here sitting next to me, she'd say, thanks, Takeda. So allow me to say, thanks, Takeda. To learn more about all the resources that Takeda has made available for the Bleeding Disorders community, visit bleedingdisorders.com. Again, that is bleedingdisorders.com. Hello, and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast, episode 42, November 18th, 2019. I am Patrick James Lynch, and I am flying solo this month. On this episode, open enrollment for 2020 healthcare coverage through the Affordable Care Act's marketplace closes December 15th. Do you need to get or change your 2020 health insurance coverage? Healthcare.gov is the place for you. We're going to talk more about that during our Like segment. The Rare Disease Film Festival featured dozens and dozens of films elevating rare disease stories. We were there, and we've got audio and takeaways from only the second iteration of this powerful and, in my biased opinion, critical new conference festival hybrid. That's coming up in the comments segment. Author and advocate Cassandra Campos McDonald joins me for the interview segment to talk about her new book, Dear Hemophilia, as well as her podcast about being the wife of a minister. Depression takes center stage during A Moment for Mental Health, and we've got updates on new podcasts, new programs, and ways for you to get involved in some 2020 Believe Limited stuff. All that plus Mama Sue and more coming up on this episode. Welcome to Bloodstream. Yes, as always, Bloodstream is packing a big lunch for you today. As mentioned, Natalie is not with me. I've been traveling for one reason, she's been on the road for another, so you'll have to go check out Meadow Nymph on Instagram if you need a Natalie fix. That's what I have to do sometimes. But as my dear friend and former Double H legendary camper Rennell would say, Patrick, the clock stops for no one. So guided by the wise words of Rennell, on to the news updates. And hey, did you hear? The long-awaited blood emoji has finally arrived. Yes, in addition to waffles, motorized wheelchairs, and sloths, Apple recently released a blood drop emoji, thrilling social media managers throughout women's health, bleeding disorders, and vampiric appreciation organizations. No longer must we bleeders rely on the actually troubling image of a syringe squirting blood to sorta represent our community. Thanks to the innovative minds working on Apple's emoji development and implementation strategy, iOS users around the globe can now revel in the joy of an emoji that looks just like, wait for it, a blood drop. Investigational drug updates continue with, I think, close to 49,000 companies now working on some type of hemophilia drug, as non-factor therapy and factor replacement therapies continue to vie for positioning in the hearts and minds of our protein-deficient community. Though, whatever your treatment, chances are you're going to hear about prophylaxis, optimization, and copay accumulator adjustment programs. They haven't gone away even after Halloween. Be careful, read closely, and phone a friend if you have trouble understanding your plan. Reminder, healthcare.gov by December 15th. One company starting to look at how hemophilia A and B affect brain development, thinking, and behavior, which is cool, while Google acquired Fitbit, and with it far more of my health information than I ever anticipated them having. Yeah, it's Google. Who am I kidding? They already had it. Plus, I get it. Apple releases a clove of garlic emoji, and it's time for Google to pick up some wearable technology. Major League Baseball's comeback player of the year, Michael Brantley, donated $20,000 to NHF because, well, you decide why you think he did that, but maybe also we need to start rooting for the Astros community-wide. I'm a Yankees fan, believe me, that's not easy for me to say, but come on. And hey, did you hear? One company mentioned hemophilia in a new mainstream commercial. That never happens. Oh, reminder, there's a health and safety summit in the new year to review things like manufacturing practices. Child Protective Services says hello to yet another bleeding disorders community family who is suspected of abuse due to unexplained bruising. This time in Houston. Michael Brantley, Houston, send help. At least this time it's on the mainstream news. Doctors cry wolf, patients who cry help, and caregivers who cry with pride to watch their rare disease child shine as an advocate and filmmaker. Reminder that women bleed too. There's no such thing as an unaffected sibling, and joint bleeds lead to permanent damage. Stating the obvious, I know. But as David Foster Wallace reminds us, not to overlook the necessary and chronic simply because it's familiar. Just as a fish casually swimming through the ocean should never reach a place where he turns to another fish to ask, what is water? Before we get started with the Like segment, it's brought to you this month by Genentech's Challenge Accepted show, which reminds me to tell you something. Bloodstream Media and Believe Limited have several story-driven, community-facing programs that we are launching next year, including a documentary on mental health and bleeding disorders, a podcast devoted to pain, and a video series about professional growth. We have got a lot, so if you have a story to tell, chances are we've got somewhere for you to tell it. If you'd like to learn more about storytelling opportunities with Bloodstream Media and Believe Limited, please email mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. Again, mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com with questions or comments, or you can connect with Bloodstream Media on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. And again, this like segment this month, a vital one, is brought to you by Genentech, creators of Challenge Accepted Show, which you've heard us talk about before, but have you seen it yet? There's new episodes coming out soon, so, you know. Hosted by magician and comedian Justin Willman, Challenge Accepted shines a spotlight on members of the Hemophilia A community as they work alongside celebrity coaches to overcome everyday challenges and get outside their comfort zones. Again, there's a new episode coming soon, so now is a great time to watch the full series and get excited for episode 7. The entire Challenge Accepted series is available right now, and you can go find it right now on YouTube by searching the phrase Challenge Accepted Show. You have to use the whole phrase, but I have a feeling if you go Challenge Accepted Hemophilia, Challenge Accepted Justin Willman, creative, clever people listen to podcasts, and I bet you'll find your way. You can also click the link in the program notes. Go watch the Challenge Accepted Show on YouTube after you listen to this like segment. Okay, this next bit of information is not just relevant to those of you out there affected by bleeding disorders, but to everybody in the USA. It is open enrollment season. It started on November 1st, and it will end on December 15th, which means right now is the time for you to enroll in or change your 2020 Marketplace Health Insurance. That time is right now. Again, on December 15th, that is the last day to enroll in or change plans for 2020. For coverage starting on January 1st. So if this pertains to you, or if you're even wondering, does this affect me? Go to healthcare.gov. There's a little drop down, getting started. If it's your first time, you can create an account with them and they'll walk you through the process. If you've been there before, you can log back in, update your application, and it'll give you different plans that you can compare for 2020. And if you'd like to do none of that logging in business, but you want to see what the plans look like, you can still find links to preview 2020 plans at healthcare.gov. This is very important. Make sure if there's people in your life that you know who might be a little behind the eight ball on this, this is the kind of thing you can't kick the deadline forward. December 15th, last and final deadline for 2020 health insurance coverage, healthcare.gov. There is also, there are resources out there from our community to help people with bleeding disorders specifically, including there's an open enrollment guide from the Hemophilia Federation of America, HFA. I will put a link to the to that in the program notes. But if you also just search for the Hemophilia Federation of America's open enrollment guide, that also may give you some of the tips that you'd find helpful to navigate through the process. Don't let your health insurance, your health care coverage go. This is too important. Healthcare.gov right now, or at least by December 15th. And tell somebody else. And now for the episode 42, a moment for mental health segment. Debbie and Amy have this episode off. Don't let anyone ever tell you I don't give people a break. Or let them tell you, but then you can say, actually, that is wrong. One time on the podcast, Debbie and Amy, and you can speak truth about my leadership habits. Anyway, Debbie and Amy, they're off, and I'm here. And I want to take this moment, as it were, to share not facts and resources today, but a personal account of living with and coming to terms with mental illness. This personal account was first written as a blog in May of 2018 and was written by me. It's by far the most popular page on my personal website, whether I like that or not. And what it tells me, what that tells me, is more than anything, just how hungry we all are for personal, relatable, honest accounts of struggling with mental illness in all its forms. So, given the reins on this segment today, I thought I would share that blog with you all here, and I hope it helps. This was originally written on May 19th, 2018, titled, Okay, I'll admit it, I'm depressed. I first used the D word around Thanksgiving of 2016. I'd once again been experiencing something of a crisis, silently, that came to a head during concentrated holiday time. I couldn't hide it anymore. And it was time to let my wife and my mother into my experience. It was scary, speaking those words out loud for the first time. I think I'm depressed, and I think I've been this way for a long time. After the holidays and a lot of talk with my family, I started therapy. Identifying unprocessed or incompletely processed trauma, personality traits, habits, and other behavioral patterns connected to feelings of hopelessness, sadness, or overwhelming circumstances, disentangling my emotions and methodically breaking down my backstory in search of clues, then identifying how these emotions and sensations translate into destructive or self-destructive behaviors if not managed effectively. Therapy, along with more open conversations with my wife, were helping. I could see how the work was benefiting me and how the routine kept me more grounded. But of course, life doesn't conveniently rearrange itself to adapt to your health challenges, and 2017 was an enormous year for me. I spent more than half of it on the road, directed my first feature documentary, and got married. Believe Limited, my company, also continued to grow, adding new projects and new partnerships, and with them, more responsibilities. It truly was an excellent year, but throughout it, I was plagued by voices in my head. How does a depressed person get married? How does a depressed person go after his dreams? How does a depressed person act as the face of an organization? How does a depressed person moderate panels on challenges and deliver keynote addresses? How does a depressed person respond to parents who tell him he's a role model for their children? How does a depressed person respond when people in his community continually ask why we don't talk more about depression? What I've learned is that a depressed person, or at least this sometimes depressed person, is extraordinarily functional. I'm lucky that way. I've always had an ability to rise to the occasion or meet the moment, regardless. No sleep? No problem. Physical pain? I can handle it. An unshakable sense that I'm standing inside a house of cards which will inevitably collapse upon me sooner or later, no matter what? Yeah, I can power through that too. For a time, anyway. But now, almost halfway into 2018, two things have become abundantly clear. Number one, there's no getting out of paying the piper. Being a highly functional person with depression who rises to the occasion and doesn't allow depression to, quote, win, is tiring and unsustainable. My sympathetic nervous system is worn out from this fight-or-flight approach to function. And while I'm not very good at this, when I do really slow down and zoom out, I'm proud of what I've accomplished thus far in my life. Dude, you've worked professionally as an actor, director, producer, writer, and podcaster. You oversee the direction of a growing, influential, and inspiring organization. Whether it was through poker, acting, or production agency work, you've traveled to more places than you can count. You met the woman of your dreams, became best friends, and then married her on an estate in Portugal. And you're only 32, dude. Life is great. Yes, it is. Also, I'm a person with depression. So while on paper, there is a lot of good to look at experientially, it's far more complicated than that. It's not that the depression negates the good, it's that both things are true. And number two, this one is the truly scary one. Mental health problems don't get better by themselves. I've lived long enough now to know better. I have too many friends who struggle, older friends who struggle even more, some who have ruined themselves, some who have killed themselves. And while I'm thankful that I haven't truly come close to suicide, I understand how people get there. It's very real. It happens, and it happens to people like me who struggle quietly. And since mental health issues don't get better by themselves, the only way to change things is to keep up the self-work today, tomorrow, and for the rest of my life. Given the nature of much of what I do, I've spent a great deal of time over the last few years thinking about half the world and how it doesn't have a regular supply of medicine for hemophilia. How literally every problem in my life is a blessing because of where and when I was born. Rationally, this context helps me not sweat the small stuff too much. Little things don't rattle or frazzle me, usually, anyway. Even medium things, like when I got food poisoning and hated life for 2 days while filming in India. I still remember thinking, I'm so lucky, this almost never happens to me. What rationale for a 102-degree fever? But that's the problem with depression. Rationale doesn't necessarily work. I know, rationally, how blessed and fortunate I am. I know how much worse off my life could be on so many levels. I truly understand that. But it's as if sometimes depression plays bodyguard against understanding's ability to influence thoughts and feelings. There's a stubborn hopelessness that rejects well-reasoned arguments for feeling positive, optimistic, or even just normal in some way. Not even terribly aspirational, but just functional. There's a stubborn rejection to even just feeling functional at times. And that's really scary. Now, you can cut off from it, escape and hide inside something for an hourglass or two, versions of numbness and diversion. And though that doesn't feel scary, Objectively, it's even scarier. It's like taking pain medication to numb yourself from the most intimate and insidious forms of pain. Not pain that aches in your bones or muscles, but in your soul. In your sense of identity and self-worth. In your understanding of survival and willpower. It's the reason that some people turn to substances as severe as heroin to escape. It's a sneakily powerful pain. And some real messed up behaviors can occur if you spend too much time in the numbness and diversion department of depression. So while I'm proud of what I've accomplished and what I've overcome and managed to get to where I am today, I know that I need to keep evolving. It's not about losing something that didn't work or finally doing something that might. It's about change, the very nature of change. It's understanding the inevitability of and necessity for change and actively participating in my experience of it. This year, I've started some healthy routines that have helped. Fighting for 7 to 8 hours of sleep each night, rigorous daily exercise, eating more mindfully, eliminating alcohol, and leaving some time each day for meditative walks or journaling. I'd also like to continue with therapy, which I must admit has been an inconsistent practice in 2018 for a variety of reasons, and I'm looking for ways to further simplify and streamline my life. If I had everything all figured out, this would be that part of the piece. Unfortunately, I, like everyone else battling with some form of mental or emotional pain, don't have all the answers. I'm still in the early days of figuring out what it is I need to continue evolving and growing as a man, husband, artist, and advocate, and I've made a bet today that part of this latest evolution involves struggling more openly. Just before wrapping up, I want to tell you one more important thing. I'm okay. I am. Really, I am. But I want to tell you I am so that you won't ask me about this the next time you see me. Because to be honest, I don't really want to talk about it. But that's part of the problem, right? Nobody wants to talk about depression, least of all depressed people. So I'm making the decision to struggle a little more openly, in part because I want to contribute to an environment that allows for this to be just a little more normal. Because the very process of struggling openly and having to articulate my experiences and thoughts into words for other human beings also tends to help me. Much in the way expression, communication, and art have helped me understand the world throughout my life. So I'm going to continue to struggle with this a little more openly from now on for the benefit of my health and the health of others. Not that I really want to talk about it. Thank you, and if you would like to read that blog, you will find it on the blog page at patrickjameslynch.com. There'll be a link in the program notes to that, as well as to this, the Mental Health Resource Guide for the Bleeding Disorders Community, an excellent resource produced by Mental Health Matters 2. You can download your own free copy of the Mental Health Resource Guide for the Bleeding Disorders Community by going to Mental Health Matters 2. That's all spelled out, including T-O-O, mentalhealthmatters2.com, and click the Resources tab to download your very own copy. You can also contact Mental Health Matters 2 founder Debbie De La Riva at Debbie, D-E-B-B-I-E, at MHMTOO.com. That's D-E-B-B-I-E at MHMTOO.com. Takeda, you may have heard of them. They do stuff in bleeding disorders such as presenting sponsor, huh? This podcast, get it? Thanks, Takeda. Takeda is also one of the sponsors of the Rare Disease Film Festival. In fact, there was a truncated version of the festival held in Boston earlier this year, made possible by Takeda ahead of the full shebang, which took place in San Francisco earlier this month. I was there on behalf of Bombardier Blood, which headlined on Saturday night, and with Bloodstream Media to help capture interviews, shares, and sounds from the Rare Disease Film Festival 2019, as well as some pictures that you can find on Twitter. If you look me up on Twitter, PJ Lynch, as well as Patrick James Lynch on Instagram, you'll find some bonus content too. I also caught up with Daniel DeFabio, the festival co-founder and last month's interview guest, as well as Academy Award winner Cynthia Wade to chat for a few minutes about her new powerful short, Beyond Blue. Kylie Ann, another filmmaker present at the festival with her film, Frasier Syndrome and Me, You'll hear multiple clips from her and her father about their experience as a rare disease filmmaker touring the festival circuit. This festival was truly a unique hybrid of the best of a health conference alongside the best of a film festival. It exceeded my expectations, and I was really thankful that I was grabbing some bits to share with you all. It will pair in comparison to the experience of being there live, but I hope these next several minutes give you a sense of what this festival was all about, and hopefully intrigues you enough to check out their website, check out some of these films, and find out where you may be able to view them. So without further ado, enjoy these clips, shares, interviews, and moments from the 2019 Rare Disease Film Festival.
It's been the most intense part of this 24-year journey. Has been the last 2 years of this clinical trial, but it has been the most rewarding to just walk through with these families and see the miracles, honestly. And so what we're seeing happening with gene therapy really gives so much hope for so many indications. It really, truly has been the most rewarding part of this journey.
We do documentaries as a way of inspiring the biomedical research industry. And we did our first film about a girl named Livia. And I knew we had an amazing family, and she is a force. And it's what a lot of these rare disease families are. They're just so driven and compassionate and just beyond just their own family, just for the entire rare disease family that's just looking for community. This woman loves these families well, and it was just an honor to help tell it.
Okay, I am at the Rare Disease Film Festival, just finished, and I put my program away before I started recording. That's not very professional to do. I got here for the 12 o'clock showing of Slate 2, Rare But Not Alone, numerous short films depicting various rare diseases, powerful films, really powerful films. And some great conversation afterwards. I actually needed a minute, so I didn't even I didn't attend the session that followed with some speakers in favor of checking out this really cool art exhibit that's here, the rare artist with various portraits, self-portraits, just beautiful work by various people with rare diseases from all around the world. I'm looking at this great one from Michaela Odery at the moment, Cripple Punk self-portrait. It's really cool. It kind of reminds me a little of Daria, for those of you who I'm dating myself, but if you guys remember Daria, kind of reminds me of her a little bit. Let's check it out. And some amazing ones of animals that remind me of a lot of Rob Bradford's photos from Africa of late. All right, so I'm going to get into the next session because it's about to start, and I will be back. All right. It's 4 o'clock on day one. We just finished Slate 3, Unconditionally Rare. 67 minutes with, what is this, 8 films. Wow, this is an emotional and powerful day. It is, there's need for energy. I'm in the back of the room. They just finished. There was a panel conversation with 3 of the filmmakers. I'm hanging around, maybe going to see if I can't speak to one of them. You know, it's funny, the films end and people are just so, you know, there's not a lot of energy for the Q&A, but oh. The filmmakers are about to leave. I'm going to go see if I can't catch one of them.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I'm here with Cynthia Wade. I was able to catch her before she got out the door. She is the director of Beyond Blue, which addresses a rare cancer, a really powerful 10-minute film. And we just wrapped up the Q&A, and she was generous to give me a couple of minutes. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi.
So tell me, what brought you here to the Rare Disease Film Festival, specifically with Beyond Blue?
Well, one of the things, very personally, is that I have spent most of my life on the East Coast and this summer moved to Los Angeles. So I am I'm now a Californian, so to come up to San Francisco is an easy thing, and I'm delighted because of the weather. I'm just delighted to be on the West Coast. But beyond that, I really love being able to connect with audiences, and I think that a film comes alive in a very new and powerful way when it's not online, but you're actually interacting with audience members.
Has Barbara, the subject of your film, and you should give the audience a little info about who she is, but has she gotten to experience the film in front of an audience?
She has. So This is a film, Beyond Blue, about a woman who's living with a very rare blood cancer. There's a series of rare blood cancers called NPNs. And so she lives with one of them and has most of her life. And they're very difficult to diagnose. You can also often be misdiagnosed. So less than 200,000 Americans have rare blood cancers. And I was really interested in telling stories from the inside out of people when they may look fine on the outside, but in fact, there are things, there's something that's quite wrong on the inside. That whole idea of like what you're projecting out to the world versus what you may be experiencing on the inside. So I did a series of short films about NPNs, and Barbara was one of the subjects. And her film, Beyond Blue, is about the fact that she has been so sick because of a bone marrow transplant, which was one of the ways in which she could battle her NPN. She could not be in water for 5 years. She couldn't swim. She couldn't go to, you know, a pool, an ocean, etc. Can't eat raw vegetables because the risk of getting sick, especially with a suppressed immune system, is so dangerous for her. And while I was getting to know her, she got the clearance to swim for the first time in 5 years. So I decided to really put the film around that, like the fact that she loves water more than anything and lives on the coast of Florida and loves the ocean and yet can't touch water and then finally is cleared to swim. And so the 10-minute film is about that and her experience of living with an NPN. She has gone to a couple of different live screenings. She's been really proud. She shared the film online. And there's actually a festival in Key West. And she was really excited about that because, of course, she's based in Florida. It's so great when you can be able, when you're able to see the value of, I mean, quote, she's, of course, extraordinary, but a quote ordinary person kind of living his or her life, that you can go in and show them how extraordinary they are by coming in and filming them and then creating a narrative that feels very true to them. And then it's a way to share the patient experience with an audience. So I that feels like a gift when I can do that for somebody. And it's really a privilege and an honor when I can do that for somebody.
I know I have to let you go very shortly. Where else can people find Beyond Blue online, and where else is Beyond Blue going for screenings?
Yes, all of the films, Barbara's film, and then the films with our other three NPN patients. They're all really different. It's the series of four films, and I have to say that in the series, I decided to base one story in water, one story in land, one story with air, and one story in, what am I missing? Oh, fire. All of the films can be seen on a website called voicesofnpn.com. That's NPN, Matthew, Peter, Nancy.com. They're also on YouTube, all four films.
And there will be links in the program notes if you would rather just click away. Final question. I did hear the word Oscar mentioned in association with your name, and forgive me, I don't fully know who I'm talking to, in full disclosure. Can you just give us 30 seconds on that as well?
Yes. In 2008, I won an Academy Award for a short documentary called Freeheld, which was about a dying policewoman's fight to leave her pension to her female life partner. And I ended up sleeping on their couch and filming them in their house as they fought this internationally watched battle. It was later turned into a Lionsgate film starring Julianne Moore and Ellen Page and Steve Carell and Michael Shannon, which I was a lead producer on. The documentary Freeheld, I bet you could find it online, but quite frankly, if anybody's listening to this, if you just go to my website and hit contact and say, I want to watch the documentary Freeheld, I will just send you the link because I definitely have a private Vimeo link. It's called Freeheld. So CynthiaWade.com. Just if you're listening to this, I'm happy to send it to you. And then the one that was nominated in 2013 is called Mondays at Racine, and it is a film about women living with breast cancer, and that's definitely on Amazon and HBO, and for a while it was on Delta Flights.
I love watching documentaries on Delta Flights. Well, actually, flights in general.
I have to tell you, I love audiences on flights, because here's the thing, is that they have to be focused,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like, they can't get up, they can't go to the fridge, they often can't check their phone. Nope. It's actually this captive audience where they pay more attention. I love audiences on planes.
An agent that we're working with on Bombardier Blood, my film that's screening here, was just saying, hey, I have a couple conversations going with airlines, And I think he wasn't expecting the level of excitement that I met that with. My wife is also a flight attendant, so it's an industry I care about too. But I have the same feeling. It's like, that's a captive audience.
Totally.
It's a mountain climbing film, and you think mountains, it's big. It's like, hey, Free Solo won an Academy Award.
That's absolutely.
I've been on a lot of planes where I've seen people watching that film on the plane. Cynthia, thank you so much. CynthiaWade.com.
Yes, W-A-D, like Wade in the water. But thank you. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate meeting you and just being here today.
Thank you. I appreciate meeting you as well.
I was born with Fraser syndrome. For me, normal is the fact that I have had 31 surgeries. I'm hearing impaired. I'm vision impaired. Because of the small roots in my teeth, there's a chance that my teeth will fall out someday. So yes, compared to the rest of the kids around me growing up, and all I've ever tried to do from the moment that I was born was live. And then how do you deal with staring?
It can be quite difficult.
Yeah.
I used to like look at London. Why are you staring at me like stuff like that? But now I'm just like, I just ignore it. If they stare at me, then I just go off with my friends.
And for a lot of kids, you know, they just kind of accept it. He has had kids that don't and are.
He's branded the monster.
Yeah.
My life wasn't normal. But it was my life.
Carmichael from the film One Shot to Live. I don't know, is there anyone else with you? Brandon, is this?
Yes.
Come on, Ab. Come on, Bo, you want to come up too? Come on. Oh, you're filming, okay. So I'm going to turn the mic over, and this is a beautiful free-for-all. So if somebody wants to launch the first question, be brave. There we go.
We're really, really close, and we've got our structure, we've got our executive producers here that have been incredible, and so we're going to be launching hopefully before the end of the year, but you can, all of that will come out on our Instagram and Facebook pages, you can follow us there.
One Shot to Live, all the things. Cool. Thank you.
Absolutely.
I have a question for Kylie.
Yes.
Is Fraser syndrome more prevalent in females? Because your movie had a
That's always the first question. It is, for some reason, I was able to find more women, but there are a lot of male cases as well. It's just the people I was able to find in Europe at that small amount of time were just so happy to all be female. But it's in both.
Question for you as well. You know, there was a mention of like, we're in this for our kids, but I was really struck that in your film, you paid such homage to the parents and the families and the connections they were able to make through all of this. And that empathy, was that always a part of the plan, or did you watch that in real time and kind of see that as a filmmaker? And
no, definitely. I hate saying this, but I went into it very naively, thinking like this was going to be this amazingly new experience for me and people with Fraser syndrome, and we were going to be able to connect on a level, and I didn't even think about my parents. I was glad that they were there, but I was like,
Mewling the luggage.
It's affected them a lot, almost more than it affected me. I've just lived. My parents had to change my tube that was falling out because of my urinary stuff. Like, they had to do way more than I had to. And there was a real eye-opener.
So tell us what your life is like now. What are you doing with yourself?
Well, currently, this is taking up my whole life. But, and happily, very happily, I am traveling around the world with the film. I just got back from London, where actually three of the interviews were shot, and they got to see the film on a big screen for the first time, which was amazing. We actually had five people with Fraser syndrome in one room, which is the first time I've ever heard of that ever happening, which was very surreal. So I'm doing that, and now I'm working on making this a feature, because I plan on telling the story for the rest of my life. I want to make it longer. This was my graduating piece from film school, and it was only able to be 20 minutes because of that, and we just touched on the stories that can be told through these people, and I want to be the one to do it.
Oh, marvelous.
I mean, all those film festivals, I cry when her film plays. I've cried at every one I've seen here today. And this is just an amazing feel to this festival, just being in this room with you people and just sharing our stories. And it's really amazing. So, Bo, thank you for doing this. This is incredible. And, you know, I'm glad I'm in this room with you people. So, It's pretty special.
We don't
want to
wait 2 more years, Bo.
when I emailed Bo early on, I told him, I was like, hey, we won't have the first episode finished, but I could do a behind-the-scenes piece. We just want to be involved. And he said, I'll never forget in the email, he said, that's fine. We just want to encourage people to tell stories. And to what you're talking about, the way that hate is squashed is with people hearing incredible stories, because stories, more so than anything else, have the power to move, motivate, and to change people's perspective. And so if you are here and have a story to tell and are hesitant to tell it, do it. I am so inspired every day by stories, so you don't know who you could be inspired with your story. So.
You know, one other really important thing about days like today, where it's emotional and long and a lot of absorbing of stuff, is eating enough food. I gotta get some lunch. I'll be right back. Okay, I'm gonna interrupt my own segment. I'm interrupting myself. How meta is that? To step away from the Rare Disease Film Festival for just a moment, but to stay in Northern California for another film festival taking place up here this month, the Napa Valley Film Festival. Bombardier Blood's not a part of that one, but my beautiful stutter is, as listeners to Bloodstream are familiar with by now. Believe Limited has 2 big documentaries that we've been working on. Bombardier Blood, that you've heard about plenty, and My Beautiful Stutter, that you have not heard nearly enough about. So I am fortunate now to be sitting across from Sarah Berkowitz. Hello, Sarah.
Hi.
Sarah is one of the subjects featured in the film along with her mom, and she is here at the Napa Valley Film Festival to be a part of the festival, to participate in the Q&A, and to, you know, start helping usher My Beautiful Stutter into the world. We just got back from a screening this morning. We haven't even had a chance to discuss this really off mic. So on mic, Sarah, what was this morning like for you?
I thought it was really cool. It was only the second time I've seen it, so it was interesting seeing myself like in front of so many people and kind of like gauging their reactions and hearing when they laugh versus, you know, what I think is funny, which is often at myself. It was really cool. I thought the Q&A was really interesting and insightful, definitely.
Tell people a little bit about the film. So you're a junior in college now. I'd love for you to share what you're doing because it's awesome. But yeah, rewind the tape for people and let them know, like, who were you watching up there on screen? What's this process and short been like for you?
Yeah, so you just want me to like summarize like my like experience in the film, or like
as best you can, and you know, the things that stick out to you. The timeline isn't as important as mm-hmm. the things that like Sarah wants to mention, as like these are the things I think about when I think about this process.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was definitely like a long process. It was basically about like say the Stuttering Association for the Young, and then how it has helped not bring people together. About how SAY has helped bring different young people together from all these different walks of life, and their different experiences with stuttering. And yeah, it was great. It was crazy to see myself from so many years ago, because I feel like I've changed so much. And I was watching some of those segments, but some of them are the same in different ways. So at one point, I think in there, like I said, I was worried about like getting married and having kids. And then it was because like I was worried about my speech and passing on those genes. But now I'm just like, I'm just don't want to deal with like adult stuff, you know, this is already too much, like give me a break. But yeah,
that sounds very typical and normal. And what are you doing now? What are you doing in college?
So I'm a junior at the University of Iowa, and I have a major in social justice and then double minors in American Sign Language and then rhetoric and persuasion. And I'm on a pre-law track, which basically means that, like, I'll be in school forever. But I really like it. I want to be a lawyer and do human rights, human trafficking, immigration type of work. And yeah, I like my school.
And why is that the kind of work that interests you?
You know, I was actually thinking about this the other day when I was writing this scholarship application. I think it all kind of ties back to, like, people without a voice and people who don't have a way to communicate for themselves. And so when you think about, you know, people who stutter and then all these other different populations, like refugees, it's struggling to, like, find a voice in this big society. So I think that's what I want to do.
That's awesome. And as my beautiful stutter is going through all these dozens and dozens of festival screenings, school and community screenings, by the way, PSA, you can request a screening. If you go to mybeautifulstutter.com and click host a screening, you can see Sarah's story unfold before your very eyes, along with her friendship to Emily, who I'm curious to ask you a little bit more about off mic, because they don't know who Emily is. But tell people what you hope the film can accomplish. What are you hoping this will change for people who stutter, will change, like, what do you hope for this film to accomplish?
I hope that this film reaches more than just the stuttering community, and I hope it can kind of spread this overall message of just trying to understand different people in different situations, and just trying to step into their shoes, because you really don't know what it's like.
And so, as a final thought, because people generally don't know what it's like to live with a stutter, what is one thing that you could offer people without a stutter, something that they should know, one thing that might make people who do stutters' lives a little bit easier?
Give us the time to talk. Don't try to finish our words. It's really annoying. Especially, like, if someone gets it wrong, and then you're like, no, that's actually not at all what I was trying to say, except now I have to spend time trying to say why that was wrong. You know, just we will get there eventually, and we will appreciate it when you wait for us.
Well, I appreciate you giving us a few minutes and sharing a bit of your story with this audience and being so open at such a young age, from being a young teenager, to be a part of this film and help share your story and your vulnerability for the betterment of the larger community of people who stutter. So I applaud you for that. I appreciate you for that. And thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Walking around now outside of the campus and outside the conference center, looking for a little bit of food, but unsuccessful. One thing about being on a campus, a lot of things are not quite fully active on the weekend. Although there's a lot of people around, but none of them do seem to have coffee cups. Somebody's eating. Weird. Weird. Although, other than this experience, I will say I have found in general that San Francisco has been a much more pleasant pedestrian city for me on this trip. So, in addition to all the great filmmaking and rare disease stuff, I am grateful for this opportunity to increase my fondness of San Francisco. So there you go. A little unintended good coming out of the festival as well, just based on location. Okay, they're really handy and they're very cheap. Prosumer technology, it goes a very long way.
Hi.
Hi, I'm with Daniel DeFabio. You remember him from the previous episode, one of the co-founders of the Rare Disease Film Festival. How are you, Daniel?
Other than a little tired, good. It's also energizing too. It's overwhelming, but it re-energizes you for sure. Like you, any big project, you start to we wonder, like, am I going to make it? And then everybody comes alive for this, so it makes it all feel worthwhile, you know.
One of the filmmakers in the last session also just talked about how when you get to screen your films in front of a live audience, it's a new experience with the film. It's something special. The film is the film. It's not theater, but in a way, it's the it's a movie theater. It's the theatrical experience of being with other people and hearing the laughs and hearing all the sniffles. My God, all the sniffles. Thank God there were tissues in the bag that you gave the filmmakers. What was it like, speaking of filmmakers, for you as a filmmaker to see your film in front of an audience today?
It's always, I think, you're always self-critical. So I'm always like, oh, the preceding film was so much better than mine. Do I stand up? You know, is it good enough? But so that's like on a filmmaker professionalism level. But on the content, you know, it's the message is important. And to see people, you know, something like you said, sometimes you hear people sort of gasp or take a big breath or nudge somebody or just, and you don't get that if you watch it alone.
Right.
You don't get that if they watch it alone at home. So that communal experience, I'm glad the other filmmakers felt that way too, that it brings it alive for them too, not just for the audience, you know.
Has there been anything unexpected about today so far? I should say, as we record this, it's approaching nearing on 5 o'clock on Saturday. Anything unexpected? It seems like things are going really well and like the schedule. Good job. You're keeping everybody moving.
Most things are going very well. One disappointment, we had a rare disease comedian for both days.
Oh, yeah.
And so she's not here today after all. She's going to be performing tomorrow. I was really looking forward to that. I think most people never heard that there is a rare disease comedian. And with a load of sort of heavy emotional films, it might have been a welcome relief, but we'll get to that tomorrow. And if you saw our zebra mascot walking around.
I got a photo with the zebra mascot. Yeah, I didn't just see him. We bonded.
That nearly went bad because that was a costume ordered from China, and I had no idea how long it would take to ship. It took over a month to ship, and as of this is Saturday. As of Monday, it wasn't in America yet. Tuesday, it was in Los Angeles. I'm like, okay, Los Angeles to San Francisco, we might just make it, and we did.
Wow. I mean, that's how it always happens, just barely. So what is still to come? What's the rest of today look like? What does Sunday look like? And what in particular is on your mind at this point in the festival? Where are you as a founder and as a parent? And I mean, you have so many hats, so many of the hats that people wear here you have. Where's your head at?
Yeah, so yet to come today, one is your film, and that's
that was not my intent. That was not trying to bait you into that.
No, but it is, we end the day with, most of our films are shorts and slates of shorts, and then at the end of the day, we have both Bombardier Blood as its own standalone feature length, and then Our Friend John in the other hall at the same time, a feature length, and those are very different experiences because you don't get the crowd that one portion of the crowd is interested in one thing, one portion's interested, they're all for a single purpose, and I'm eager to see how that goes. And then tomorrow there's a slate that I hope goes over well. It's leaving all the documentaries out of it, and it's only the films that are narratives or fictional or fantasy or animated, so that, you know, if anybody was feeling overwhelmed by documentaries, that's their refuge, right? Yeah.
You know, you talk a little bit about, I know I gotta let you go here in just a minute, but just talking about quality of film and that film came before mine. One of the things that has stood out to me is the programming, the order of the films, and there does seem, I'm sure there is intentionality behind it all, but the programming, the design elements of the conference, the branding, all the little things that really crystallize this as a true branded experience for a new kind of community with new concentric circles. Are you feeling that? Because I'm experiencing that as an attendee, and it's exciting to me, and I hope you as the creator are feeling that.
I'm glad you respond to that, because we do work on that a lot, and I have a background in marketing, graphic design, so that kind of stuff's important to me too. And somebody once told me, like, if you're on a low budget, the easiest thing you can do is just get one color and stick to one color for a cohesive, consistent thing. And I was like, well, three, let's go with three colors. So, but it does, this year it's a lot of purple. Last in 2017, it was a lot of green, and those are our three colors, purple, green, and orange. But yeah, in terms of sort of the programming, the slates, and it's a little trickier to get a balance when, you know, so many of yours are documentaries and they're a little bit downbeat, you know, or heavy. And so to work against that as much as possible, I tried to, on every slate, to have a non-documentary in the mix. So there'd be a little bit of a change up. And then also just, is this a more epic film, or is this a little more small, intimate film? Just whatever variation we can find, rather than I'm going to hit you again. Here's another tough story. I'm going to hit you again. I want to find variety, even though every film is a desperate, sad story.
Yes, and very worthy of its own attention. But again, that you're giving each its own placement from an event perspective in a great way. So applause for that. Enjoy the afternoon, and I'm excited for this evening. And Bombardier Blood this evening. I'm excited to share it with this audience.
Yeah, great. I can't wait to see it with you.
Thanks, Daniel. Wait, Josh, what did you say?
I didn't get the gum. There was fruit stripes gum.
I have some. Do you want? Rob got some.
I'll take
did
a
he
bite.
Get the last? Well, did you get the last fruit stripes?
Regardless, he can't have any. I got.
Why can't Josh have the fruit stripes?
I'm allergic to dairy.
That's gum. That's not. You don't have to worry about that with gum.
That's
I like how you switched the hats. Wow, yeah. You're gonna wear that for the. That's good for the photos. Good for the promotion.
Does it look okay? Is it too tight?
No, it looks
I have a
very
wide.
Handsome.
My head has a wide girth.
The orange in the hat matches your beard and shirt, so there's a lot of coordination. Sort of shoes, kind of too.
Yeah, accidental.
You're very well coordinated. Rob's probably working.
I'm texting.
I'm already wearing the hat.
Does that one have the fruit stripes, Jenny? Jenny doesn't know what's happening, so she's not going to participate in the podcast because I just stuck a thing in front.
Are you sure?
Thank you very much.
Oh my God!
Hey, look at you! You made
tattoos
friends
inside. He wasn't lying.
Probably keep those
Thank
too.
You
I bet.
So much.
Josh is a cinematographer. I have a question for you, Josh. I actually don't know that you and I have actually talked about this in a meaningful way. You couldn't be like me. We weren't on Everest, but still, you want to set the vision. You want to articulate what you have in your head as a cinematographer. What was that process like, and were there any curveballs are particularly interesting, you know? Just anything that stands out to you from that process.
We watched a lot of TV. Rob and I watched pretty much everything that has ever been filmed about Everest and came up with our own ideas of what we thought it was going to be like based off of that. Finally, Rob came up with luckily a flawless plan. We didn't know it was flawless when we made it, but to just have tons of batteries and wires hooked up to GoPros and wire Chris up and tell him what not to do, like don't look at your feet the whole time, and filming as much as he could, you know, while spending how many days?
The whole thing it was 62, including the hike up and everything was 62 days.
And I think the most rewarding thing about handing it off to Rob was that morning where I got a text message that was a screen capture from the summit of Everest, and it was crystal clear, and Rob was like, the whole thing's clear. He made it, and we shot it. I don't know how, but he made it up Everest, and we have footage of it now.
Yeah.
What was it like for you?
Thank you. It's not me. It's Chris. Those are his shoes. Actually, I can't take credit for those shoes or those shots. The filming, the stuff that you're seeing up there on the up on the mountain, those beautiful shots, is either done by cameras that I fixed to Chris, so I'll take that credit, or by one of the two climbing Sherpas that are with him. These guides that are just beasts of human beings. They're incredibly strong and incredibly smart, and are one of them was up there without oxygen and filming this and was able to stay coherent and was.
Actually,
he didn't
use oxygen
for the most part. No.
All right, recording this Sunday morning from the hotel. Wow, yesterday was something. 25 films across about 9 hours. Spoiler alert: one of them was Bombardier Blood. The last one, when I didn't have much left, which was okay because I know that film pretty well. What a day, though. I mean, the number of films and filmmakers who presented. It was so inspiring, and I'm just blown away by what Bo and Daniel have taken the time to really thoughtfully curate and organize. It was truly one of the most special days that I have experienced as an advocate and a filmmaker alike. We had films that were looking at all kinds. We had, you heard a little bit about Fraser syndrome earlier, USP7, Tay-Sachs disease, rare cancers, I can't even pronounce a lot of these things. Mitochondrial disease, Huntington's disease, Fragile X, Menke syndrome, NGLY1, PAX1 syndrome. Just all these different populations that don't have media opportunities. And when they do, much like our community, they wind up focused on the internal, our inner community. We have a tough time getting accurate, empathy-driving media into the mainstream, into the bloodstream of culture. And that's hopefully what the Rare Disease Film Festival can do. It's only a matter of time, in my belief, that something like this could launch a film that goes on to make waves in the general public and help put this festival on a whole nother platform. It's only its second incarnation, and it's already off to a great start in bringing together experts, specialists, clinicians, advocates, and filmmakers and storytellers. So I'd say Bo and Daniel are certainly off to an amazing start. I am honored to have been a part of it. I'm glad to have been able to share it with Rob and Josh, to be able to talk to about our film together in front of a nice diverse audience, and to have met a few new hemophilia families as well through the experience. So very happy about that too. Going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with my interview with hemophilia community member Cassandra Campos McDonald. Okay, joining me now, I have Cassandra Campos McDonald on the line. Let me tell you a little bit about who Cassandra is. The bleeding disorders community knows her well, but for those who aren't acquainted, Cassandra's passion for writing as an outspoken blogger and advocate began out of loneliness in 2006 when she and her family moved to the mountains of New Mexico. She began writing a blog and has written over 800 posts over the years on blogs about her life and faith and raising her sons with hemophilia. She has been a contributor to the mighty Scary Mom Global Genes and the Hemophilia Federation of America's Infusing Love blog. Cassandra is also a columnist for Hemophilia News Today, wrote a monthly column on faith for The Herald, and is also a regular writer for L.A. Kelly Communications. She is also an author with a book coming out very soon, if not already, and that is kind of what we're here to talk about this morning. Well, it's morning now. I don't know when you're listening. Hello, Cassandra. How are you?
Hi, I am great. Great to be with you, Patrick.
Of course. Well, congratulations. Writing a book is no small feat. Congratulations. Let's just start there.
Thank you. It's truly a journey. It is not a small feat, but you learn a lot about yourself when you take on this kind of task.
Yeah, I can only imagine. And obviously, as I was just reading, you are a prolific writer. You've done a lot of writing. I'm curious, this is a big task to take on, writing a book. What spurred on wanting to write specifically a book?
You know, it's not something I ever thought I would do. And honestly, I didn't think writing would be such an important part of my life. My original degree, if you will, my first career was that of music. I'm a music educator, and that's where my passion always was. And then things changed when I had a son with hemophilia, and you know, life just goes a different direction. And when I started blogging, and just that for me was my outlet. I had to get all of that craziness and those emotions out. And for me, blogging just seemed like the thing to do. And I just started doing it with the hopes of not for anyone to read what I wrote. It was just for me to get it out there. And there's just something about that that is that's a release for me. But when I started looking at, you know, other sites and the Mighty, which is a wonderful digital health community. It's one of those sites that it connects people that have, you know, they're facing health challenges and disabilities, and I would read them. And one day they had a prompt. This was about 5 years ago, six, maybe 7 years ago. I can't remember. It's been a while, but they had a prompt and they said, write a letter to your illness. And I'm like, heck yeah. I just sat there and I wrote a letter to the inhibitor, because my youngest son, both of my sons, have lived with inhibitors. My 23-year-old has been tolerized for years, and my 13-year-old still lives with an inhibitor. But at the time, his inhibitor was just devastating him and the family, and it was just a nightmare. And so I wrote this letter. I didn't even proof it, and I sent it in, and they published it. And I'm like, okay, you know, it was just one of those moments. I'm like, I got to write about this, because I was in a very bad place with that inhibitor. I was really upset, and just, we were just, you know, our heads were just knocking with the doctors and didn't know what to do. And it was really bad. It was a painful time. And so once I wrote that, I thought, you know what, that could be a book, that dear hemophilia, that dear inhibitor. And so that's how the idea came to me. And it wasn't until years later that I started seriously considering writing the book. And so people ask me, well, why did you write this? It's, you know, your life is still going on. Your kids, you know, one of your kids is young. And then I started to think, well, why am I writing this? And when I really thought about the difference between an autobiography, which, you know, you write about your life from birth until the current time, and then a memoir, which, you know, a memoir basically takes these, you know, anecdotes from your life, this theme of your life. And I was ready. So 4 years ago, I started this journey of writing a book. And I wanted to close, not close. I mean, you never close anything with hemophilia. I mean, you know that. But this journey that we had with my son's inhibitor, because my youngest son, Caleb, I call him my mighty warrior, Caleb, he lived with an inhibitor and suffered. I don't like to use that word lightly, but he suffered the effects of an inhibitor as if he was living in the 1950s. I mean, that's how bad. He had an allergy to eight. He had, I mean, all kinds, 7 ports, 2 target joints. I could go on and on. I needed to come to a place where I could say, okay, we can breathe now. Because as of today, he hasn't had a bleed in 5 years. And
oh, great.
And did I ever think his life would be this amazing and his quality of life this good? Absolutely not. I never did. And so
attribute that to, in short? I don't mean to derail you, but that's fantastic for somebody with inhibitors who hasn't bled in 5 years. What do you chiefly attribute that to?
Well, he was on a great treatment using a plasma-derived product, and we infused it. He was on immune tolerance, so we infused him every day. And, you know, when you use a plasma-derived product, we're talking, you know, 60 cc's of product. This is a lot, and it's a hard push. Yeah. But you know what? It was great. It was working. His inhibitor was lower than it had ever been. And we went into the doctor, and she said, I think it's time to switch to a new drug. I'm like, why? And she pointed to my bag of supplies, and she said, it can be better. And I'm like, holy cow, I guess maybe it can. Okay, let's give it a try. So now he does a sub-Q medication once every 2 weeks. And to say life is amazing is just an understatement.
That's fantastic. Fantastic to hear. And again, didn't mean to derail where you were going, but just couldn't let that go without asking for a little clarity, because that's wonderful to hear.
Yeah. And just, you know, this book was just my thoughts, my journaling, my blogging, and just putting it together, because I find it as what I truly believe is, you know, those of us who are suffering or living with different illnesses, you know, bleeding disorders or not, I think there's a way that we can redeem our experience. For me, it was, I need to share. And some people, I know there are people out there, well, she just shares too much. Talk about oversharing. If my story can help one person go, holy cow, I know exactly what she means, and that person doesn't feel alone, then I feel like part of that story of either of my sons or mine as a mother, a caregiver, you know, who's been through all of that right along with them, has been redeemed. And for me, I mean, it doesn't get better than that. Do I wish we didn't go through it? Well, sure. You know, I would love to take away all that pain that my kids went through. But it was what it was. You know, and we make the best of it. And here is the thing, is that the importance of this book is, like I said, it's not just about my story, but it's about our story as a community. The fact is, your story is your story. I can guarantee you there are people who have worse stories than I do. It's not a competition.
Sure. Right.
You know, it's not a competition whose story is worse, because there's always somebody in a worse place than you. But the thing is, if you're sitting at a table with people and somebody says something and you're like, oh my gosh, that's me.
Yeah.
Then they just shared their power of their story, made an impact on somebody that they never would have reached before. So that is my message, is that we've got to share our stories. We need to not be afraid to share and talk to each other and be in connection and be in community with one another.
So the book is called Dear Hemophilia, Finding Hope Through Chronic Illness. And there is an available, I see here, I'm on Cassandra's website, Cassandra C. McDonald. And it's Cassandra with a Z, Cassandra C. McDonald.com. You can also Google her. Just make sure you go to the website that has the C in the middle. And there is a spot there where you can enter your name and email address for information information when the book is available for purchase. Is that the best place people can go, or is there somewhere else people should go for information about the book?
They can sign up. I'm going to start a monthly e-newsletter that'll go out. Hopefully this month will be the first one, and they can get information on purchasing the book, but it will be on Amazon, hopefully within the next 2 to 3 weeks, just waiting on the last hard copy to come in and make sure we're good to go. And I took a new approach with this, and I wrote a letter. The beginning of every chapter, there's a little short letter to hemophilia. And I end each chapter with what I have learned, what I wished I would have known. And so that's just the format of the book. And it was a really intriguing way for me to go through and remember and learn a little bit more about myself, because we tend to forget those bad things and those horrible times. We sort of put them away. But yeah, it's been a great journey.
If you put them away, those stories don't get to shine, right? That power of those stories doesn't get to move forward. So it's important to be told. So again, it's Dear Hemophilia, Finding Hope Through Chronic Illness. If you go to CassandraCMacDonald.com, you can enter your name and email there for more information. It will be available on Amazon. It sounds like by the end of November at the latest, so you can check there directly if you would like. I'd also recommend checking out Cassandra's website. You can see a little more about what she does. She's also a speaker and a podcaster. Tell us a little bit about your podcast.
Well, it's very different, and I am not nearly as professional as maybe your podcasts are, Patrick, but everything I know about podcasting, I learned from YouTube. I do a podcast the other part of my life. My husband is a United Methodist pastor, and I'm a seminary student, so our faith life is very important to us. I started this podcast called The Fish Bowl because that's kind of what you feel like when you're a clergy family. Everybody's watching you, but it really reaches more than just clergy spouses. It reaches all people who are active in ministry or in their organizations or nonprofits. I'm really hoping to get some nonprofit people on the podcast. But when we're always in the public eye and being watched, you know what that is like. So that's my podcast. It's been going for a little while, once a month kind of episode thing. But yeah, it's been fun and really interesting. And again, it's another way that people share their story.
So check out Cassandra's podcast as well. And again, Dear Hemophilia will be out very soon. Thanks so much for coming on today and good luck. This is really exciting. I'm excited to follow along, and we'll be sure to share when there's social media posts once it is in fact launched.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Takeda is the presenting sponsor of the Bloodstream podcast. And one more time, I want to give them a big thank you for that. Finishing up now with Mama Sue's streaming recommendations. Quick note, unfortunately, I misplaced my audio from this call with Mama Sue. So while her audio will sound the way it usually does, I'm going to sound horrible. So apologies for that. But seeing as you've stuck around to listen to the Mama Sue segment, we didn't want to not deliver it just because Patrick screwed up his own audio. So bear with us and please enjoy this subpar execution of the episode 42 Mama Sue Streaming Rex segment. Be back on the other side with the wrap up.
Now time once again for the most important segment on the Bloodstream podcast, where you learn what it is you should be watching if you aren't already. Of course, before we get to that, I want to one more time thank our presenting sponsor, Takeda, for their support of the Bloodstream podcast. Find out about all of Takeda's support for the Bleeding Disorders community at bleedingdisorders.com. Mama Sue, how are you?
Very good. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. I'm glad to be talking to you about streaming recommendations. You have three very different recommendations today and one bit of a curveball that we're going to finish with. But let's start with this title, Modern Love. What is Modern Love?
Modern Love is a new release on Amazon, and it's 8 different short segments, about 40 minutes each, on all different kinds of love. It's all takes place in New York City. It's all based on true stories. I believe a New York Times series that they ran. And it's about stale love, older love, young love, love of a child, unrequited love. And they're all very heartwarming, all very easy to relate to, and pretty much feel good. Good TV. I would recommend it. I would really recommend it.
What led you to watch that? So it's a little outside of the kind of things you typically tend to watch. What led you to watch that?
I can't really say. I did see that it was up for some awards. I was reading it, you know, it just flashed ahead, and I said, oh, let me give it a try. And they're very short, so I figured, oh, if this is corny or, you know, something that's been done before, I'll just turn it off. But I liked it, and I watched all 8 of them in a row.
Well, how about this? Did you know that the creator of it is an Irish film director from Dublin?
I did not know that.
Well, how about that? You know, just trying to get a little closer to the family.
They all took place in New York City, which I liked.
Did any of it feel relatable or remind you of anything from your life in New York City?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they show the streets of New York and New Yorkers just living their life and just experiencing happiness, sadness, all with love, related to love. So I would say give it a shot, definitely.
Well, Mom, I would really love if you could tell me who I am, if you know what I'm talking about. Tell me who I am, Mom. Tell me who I am. What is tell me who I am?
Well, tell me who I am is totally different than Modern Love. This I saw on Netflix. It's new this year. It's out of England. It's about a pair of English twins. And at 18 years old, one of the twins is in a near-fatal motorcycle accident. And when he wakes up, he has total amnesia, except to know the face of his twin brother. He has no memory of the previous 18 years of his life. So he turns to his twin brother to fill in the gap, not just to fill in the gaps, to tell him about his past and his life and his family. So he does. And I don't want to say too much about it, just that the brother decides to give him a very idyllic past, which is not true at all about the life that the two of them led. And the way it was filmed, you know, it's the real actors. It's a documentary movie. And they have the one brother talking, and then they go to the next, you know, film, and they have the other brother talking about the different ways they viewed it and why the brother told him different things and were true. And of course, the one brother was a bit resentful because from 18 to 32, he believes everything his twin brother told him. And then, you know, you'll find out what, you know, what happens and how everything starts to come undone. But it's sad, but it also shows the love of the twin, because it wasn't easy for him to not tell his twin brother the real truth, you know.
Sure.
So he had to live a lie just to make his twin brother be happy. So I'm fascinated with twin relationships anyway, identical twin relationships, how they love each other and care about each other. So this is a really, really good documentary film. I highly recommend it.
Okay. So Tell Me Who I Am, Modern Love, two very different options depending on your mood. And this is another very different option. Kind of harkens back to a Christmas gift from not long ago, which we may or may not talked about yet. I'm not sure. But why don't you tell us what else you have in mind for today?
Well, what I've been watching for the last few seasons, and you know, a lot of people kind of scoff at reality TV. I've been watching 90 Day Fiancé, and if anyone's interested, November 3rd, they just started a whole new season of it. You can catch up and watch
now,
it.
Presumably everybody knows 90 Day Fiancé in and out, but for the handful of people who don't, you want to give us the basic premise?
Well, it's about Americans. They follow about 5 or 6 Americans each season, and they're bringing their fiancés from other countries over on a 90-day fiancé visa. They have 3 months to either marry the fiancé or the fiancé has to leave. It's wildly popular, and there's been many spinoffs from this series, actually. 90-day fiancé the other way, where the fiancé the American, for one reason or another, goes to the fiancé's home country. And then they have 90-day fiancé before the 90 days, when the American has to go. Apparently, you have to prove you've met this person and lived and know them well in their own country. But this is the original that's coming on, that's on right now, 90-day fiancé. And, you know, some of them are successful. You do hear afterwards that they were successful. The majority of them are not successful for one reason or another. You know, the American, in this country of 300 million people, can't seem to find someone to meet, so they meet someone in another country, usually online.
Right.
And the ones from the other country, usually, not every single one, but usually are coming from desperate poverty, desperate right. countries, and they just
right.
will put up with some very strange Americans or strange situations, or some of them are users. And like right now, this season,
what's one of the stranger situations? Can you give us an example of one of the strange situations?
I'll tell you, last season in 90 Day Fiancé The Other Way, a 61-year-old woman, white woman, fell in love online with a 30-year-old Indian man from Delhi, I believe. And they love each other. And she went over, and his family, of course, his parents were younger than her. Long story short, these two are going to be together. I mean, the family tried to break them up and all kinds of pressure, her family, his family. And like, it sounds strange to us, but yeah, but to me, that was a very strange one. You know, she's over there now, I believe, with him.
Well,
so
all
I
right.
think it's,
sounds like
it's
a success story.
Yeah, it's a fun show. You know, it's a lot of fun. It's light, it's fun. And you do learn things too about the laws and the desperation that some people feel, both the Americans and the foreign people, to change their life. So it's
now,
interesting.
You've been single for a little while now, Ma. I don't know. Have you ever considered turning to those in desperate need from foreign nations via the internet to see if your love could be met by someone like that?
I'm not at that point yet. I have, you know, about 300 million to go through in this country before I would venture out into to other countries.
Uh-huh.
But thank you for asking.
Okay. Well, it's good to know that you're keeping in mind up to 300 million Americans as potential life partners for you. That's a really nice thing to know. Very open-minded person. Did you just share good news, too? A new season's coming out soon. People can catch up and get ready
yes.
for the new season.
It's out right now. November 3rd, it started, but you can catch up on demand. 90 Day Fiancé, and it's a lot of fun to watch. So it's very entertaining.
I don't know what people would do with all these accounts without you. They wouldn't know what to watch.
By the way, Patrick, that's on TLC.
TLC, gotcha. So 90 Day Fiancé on TLC.
Yes.
Thanksgiving this year, we won't be together, unfortunately. I'm going to be out of the country. But what are you, people will be listening to this around Thanksgiving, maybe on their way to Thanksgiving. What are you doing this year for Thanksgiving? What are you looking forward to?
For Thanksgiving, I'm going to be at my uncle's house with my cousins, which isn't too far from my house. We'll spend Thanksgiving there. And then Thanksgiving weekend, I'll be seeing Natalie's parents. We have some plans to do some touring around Manhattan. So that's
you guys
my Thanksgiving.
You all might be closer than Natalie and I at this point.
Oh, yeah. We like each other a lot more than we like you guys. We spend a lot of time together.
Not unclear. before we let you go, give me Thanksgiving, most overrated part, most underrated part.
Most overrated part of Thanksgiving, too much food. Sometimes I think it can be excessive and just not necessary. Underrated, just
almost
being,
always, usually.
Always. And I think the best part of Thanksgiving is just being grateful for your life and especially, family, friends, health, just being, feeling blessed and grateful.
Well, I'm grateful for you and I'm grateful for this segment. So thank you once again for providing us with some great streaming recommendations, Mom.
You're welcome, honey.
And that is all for this episode. Natalie will be back with me next month for one more episode in 2019. We'll be giving you a heads up on everything going on with Bloodstream Media in 2020. There's a lot. I'm excited to be able to share it next month. So do come back third Monday of the month next month for one more 2019 Bloodstream podcast episode. Special thanks to everyone at Believe Limited, the National Hemophilia Foundation Entertainment to Effect Change, the Hemophilia Alliance, the Rare Disease Film Festival, and our presenting sponsor, Takeda, as well as our likes segment sponsor, Genentech. Subscribe to the Bloodstream podcast and the Ask the Expert podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave us ratings, share our shows, and help spread the word. You can email us, remember, mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. You'll also find Bloodstream on facebook.com/bloodstreammedia and at Bloodstream Info on Instagram and Twitter. Reminder, check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player or on Bloodstream Media, bloodstreampod.com for links and additional information about the various stories featured on this episode. My name is Patrick James Lynch, and until next time, take self-care of yourself. Bye, everybody.